I'd like to thank Stephen for his introduction, and I would like to thank Paul for inviting me to read some poems from my recent collection. It's a long time since I read in Cork. The last time I think it was when Tom Mullins was teaching, was lecturing in the university, and he asked me to come along and read some of my poems to the students. But that's a long time ago, so I'm very, feel very honored that Paul asked me to come along this evening. And he has enabled me to achieve a sort of ambition of mine, because I spent some of my boyhood years here in Cork City, and I was always interested in words and images, and I was intrigued by the name The Long Valley. At the time, at the end of the 30s, or beginning of the 40s, there was a very sad film called How Green Was My Valley. And I learned from the film how green was that valley, but I could never figure out how long was the long valley, because like Protestant churches, popes of all descriptions were severely off limits to good Catholic boys. So it's been many, many years indeed, and it's taken until this evening for me to see how long is the long valley. So thank you, Paul. The poems in my book aren't made out in categories, but if there were, I think there would be five. There would be poems. There are poems about people, poems about places, poems about wildlife, poems about personal experiences, and poems that are based on stories. So I'll ease myself in by the way, I'll read some poems from all of those quasi categories, and I'll ease myself in with reading a poem about a place. It's a favourite place of mine, Long Strand in Owen Hinsha. Some of you may know it. I was brought up in Kinsale. I've always had a great love of the sea, and now I am stuck inland in Dunlanby. So occasionally when the fine weather comes, as it came during June, I do what the lady does in the country and western. I take a blanket and lay it on the ground in Long Strand. And this particular poem now is a traditional shape of a poem. Long Strand. I push string around here, but eventually I'll find it. Page 56. Long Strand, Owen Hinsha. Is the ocean tired of being a virgin? Is it for a romp with land she craves? How else explain the spumy, mad excitement of the final seven waves? South of here there is a workshop. The craftsman is the sea. He is turning a silver chalice on a bench between sun and me. Like office workers short on time, the ebb tide waders gorge their lunch. But in the languid lake behind the dunes, a heron paces out his steady haunch. Autumned like a carmine leaf, that's how I see the scarlet butterfly, all the more brilliant because nameless to my untutored eye. From the stags all the way to the galley, all those 20 miles of sea are as empty as the blue whale had it before man ever hollowed a tree. The next poem we're going to read is Counting the Young Swallows. This is what used to happen in Goline when my garage became an annual nursery for swallows. Page 46. Good thing I wrote down that. Here we are. Counting the young swallows. How many swallows do I have? I asked myself on Sunday. My garage is a nursery. My curiosity a college. They leased the place in summer rows. All the rent I charge is knowledge, which isn't much considering my opal has to sleep with bums from May to late September. But I was never very good at sums, and swallows make difficult digits. So when I called some census day, all I could see in their pot of clay was a stirabout of fidgets. How many nestlings can I see? I asked myself on Tuesday, which was a day when from Kell to Croom the coast exhaled like a film saloon, and the nicotine tally I got was 3. I saw 3 cigarettes protruding over the edge of the ashtray nest, but tails, I found, don't calculate the best. When next I stood man darkness at the door with Thursday's question, face to faces, the answer that I got was 4. There were sitting 4 of them compressed like a photo group of kitten kin in a basket, that most photographed of places. So was that? When Ladder looked for more, the parent birds protested with such din, I did no more intruding. How many fledglings do I fly? I asked myself. High Sunday. It was a day for being out in air. There were swarms of bee furs everywhere, yellowing the hills. The wind threw cushions at the child-bright sun, and clothes on lines were blatantly defying the Sabbath rest and flinging limbs like Russians. No wonder that the swallows brought their youngsters flying. I was there to see them in my airshow garden, and though I scrambled interceptor eyes, I could not outmaneuver twisting skies or count how many planes were in that squadron. But then delightfully they tired, and when the adults banked at crippling pace, they clipped like clothes pegs on exhausted wires. That's when I got the final tot. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the lot. Swallows always give me a lift, and I'm sure they give you, all of you, a lift as well. The next poem is based in a place, in a nursing home, where you don't get much of a lift unless it's a lift bringing you from one level to the other. And there's a descent rather than a lift there. I know lots of nursing homes because at my age, many of my contemporaries, my friends, are in nursing homes, so I've been visiting nursing homes quite a lot. And up to 2 years ago, I was visiting an old school friend of mine, Dennis Trahan, in a nursing home in Ballinora. But Dennis hadn't much to say for himself, and so I got to know much better a man called Brendan. And Brendan had a lot to say about himself. Nobody in the nursing home believed the words he said, because in fact it was all invented. It was all made up. It was all in his mind. And the people in the nursing home regarded him either as a terrible liar or as a complete lunatic. But after a while, I realized that what Brendan was doing was, he was living in a landscape of his imagination. And in that way, he was able to push away, keep a long arm's length, the awfulness of the nursing home. And Brendan died about in 2008, and I wrote this poem after he died. The stilts his stories strode upon are now returned to the circus ring of dreams. The ladders that they climbed are stretched out cold in the shed of the Apocrypha. He had a garage vintage full of blue Bugattis and of Duesenbergs. He owned a seascape house from where he kept a tally of the million waves from galley to the stags. And he had looked into the tomb of treasured Tutankhamun before they zooed the jackal with the silver paws. Only in his head, the others in the day room said. Neither did I believe the tales, but I had faith in what he did. And what he did was trade his wheelchair for the 46 Royale and drench his eyes in surf by looking at their puny pool of lawn, and filled his wretched room with a chest of cedar wood, an alabaster vase, and a chair on legs of gold. Is that also what they do in the final hell, which is eternal emptiness? Are they all Brendans, dousing pain with an imagined bliss? And does our make-believe make our belief a deeper doom? Oh, storytelling God, don't make his afterlife any sadder than this has been. Give him at least a bright illusion like his morning school, when gospel stories strode on stilts and Jacob's angel ants ran up and down a ladder. I'll read you a story poem next. I came across this in a book on the Coptic Christians in Egypt. Macarius, the Abba Macarius, is one of their wonder workers, a sort of Eastern France of Assisi. This is the Abba Macarius speaking of the Abba Macarius and the antelope. People think a monastery is an ancient ear, but that's not so. It is many young demanding mounds. one lactating day, exhausted from being milked by far too many eager questions, I walked out to the Wadi al-Natroom to see the lizards suck the silent sun. And there an antelope like Gabriel in our Mary fresco, delicate and pleading, came to me for help. Like an acolyte aiding me up the geriatric steps of our monastery altar, she lifted up the hem of my abbot robe and tugged me to a cradle in the birthing grass. What I saw there were three newborn with faces set in stone. One by one, she lifted them. One by one, she put them in my lap, as though it were a pouch, and I were one of those long striding birds that the merchants from the Black Face South have told me of. Lord Jesus Christ, I prayed, out of your mouth we live. Give to these little ones life from their mother's mouth. Under the canopy borne by their mother's legs, I put her blessed Trinity, and there, in reverence, they went to her nippled sacrament. And I walked back to Al-Natroom, singing the canticle, O All Ye Works. And I added on a 50th line to the prophet Daniel's 49, and to antelopes of the Wadi, bless the Lord. Poem next. It's called The Garden Seat. It's kind of Wordsworthian sort of thing, emotion recollected in tranquility. It's the sort of thing that has happened to everybody, what might have been, but wasn't. The Garden Seat. Garden Seat. This poem was written a few years ago, but it goes back a long, long way, 1943. The Garden Seat, Kilmurry, 1943. A tennis court interpreting the language of a girl's limbs, and a conniving hedge around the court. My memory has a neck like a giraffe's, and I can crop the top of it and see the garden seat below. 60 winters have erased the liner's line. The tennis net has decomposed into a tumulus of fiber worms, but the garden seat still gleams like a prop on a spotlit stage. Monica and I are sitting there, dividing its moralistic length. She is 16, and I am 2 with that. My right arm was a limp attachment for the racket on my lap. It could have been a stir, like the trunk of the elephant I had seen in Duffy's circus, clasping a gymnast's waist. It could have flowed as sinuous around her little knolls as the meander I learned about in Michael Roach's class. But no, it was a plaster cast that didn't move. That evening was the first time any girl in my indoctrinated life broke from a large group photograph and raced through eager doors and swinging eyes into a mind that was a lumber room packed up with books and priestly destiny. She was the blossom, yes, the very first upon an apple tree that had no crust of Bible bark. I'll read a poem now for my niece. This poem again was written only 2 years ago, but the background is that my little niece, my sister's daughter, came from England to visit us on a holiday. She was 6 years of age, and for the fortnight that she stayed with us, she was outrageously petted, and so when they were getting ready to go back to Bedford after the fortnight, she shed copious tears. And this particular poem is about one of the tears. Tear. Sorrows like young cuckoos took over the nests of her eyes, ejecting tears one by one like pitiful pipit cheeks. It was the end of her Irish holiday, where every day was Sunday dressed in the petting of her Irish kin. English love was only a jumper and skirt. For 2 spinning weeks, the County Cork placed her in the middle of a circus ring, but back in England, she would only be an onlooker in the sixpenny seats. Teresa was only 6 years old, but she knew with the certainty of pain that after her feet had had the run of fields, Bedford would stub her heart with walls. I cut one tear and whirled it through a secret pocket in my coat. Come back for it, I said to her. It would be distilled into a pearl. The child who left did not return. The girl who did return outgrew the tear. It evaporated in the shine of a 10-year-old's urbanity. I'll read a section out from my favorite in the collection. If it isn't the best poem in the collection, certainly the best experience. It's The Day of the Dolphins. When it happened on Long Strand, and incidentally, it was my preferred title for the collection, but the editor decided that dolphins were somewhat passé, with fungi and all that sort of thing, so he went for a different poem as a title for the collection, The Moon Canoe. But anyway, here goes with a section of the Day of the Dolphins. There were only 4 waves out from shore, closer than a parabola of sportive stone, exiles returning to mammalian land to get a close-up of their walking kin. Some of us said that there were 3, others said 5, and five they were, for sure, when their fleet of dorsal fins, like model yachts close hauled, went racing by. One man called them a pod, another said a school. We were a pod of envy green, eight inert peas of human sameness. We were a school let out to chase the circus wagons into town. They were torpedoes, weaponry of God, aiming at sea bass. They were a flash flood sweeping through the glen between the fourth and the fifth sloping of the waves. In Durban or Los Angeles, you'd have to sit on concrete to see this. And handlers would supercharge the dolphin engines with coax fuel. Here, they were running on the energy of free life. And we were all shouting, eight of us hallooing, louder than 100 kids in Durban or Los Angeles. One thing we couldn't do was match their speed. With feet that felt like dredgers in the sand, how could we emulate the pace of bodies smooth by a million years massaging in the sea? So smooth, they left not even a bubble of a wake. In line astern, arching like they were a serpent of the deep, they thrust towards the eastern ends Dundada Horn, only pursued by breathless eyes. But when we thought they would explode the rocks, they did a handbrake turn and headed west again to where we were, back along the fourth and the fifth wave glen, scimitars of speed, cetacean submarines, making gibberish of our tongues, joggers of our hearts. At this peak point, whatever else the textbooks teach, I opt for school. Above the blind word pod, because a master magnified his role with an emphatic thump upon a desk. A male erupted from the sea and drew a leaping arc upon the blue board of the sky and placed a great tiara on the day's raised head. And then a curse on gravity, that ass's law, whacked the water with two flukes like ears of elephants, detonating shrapnel of bright spray. Our sum of 500,000 added words combined was straightaway reduced to one exclamatory children's phrase, "Oh, wow! There is a world of wonder in a wow." No other animal has hearing such as theirs, and having heard humanity's applause from us eight leggets on the beach, he rocketed again into the startled air and slapped a hand with the admiring sea. "Oh, for a camera," a new arrival cried. "Forget the camera," I hissed. "Just blink the shutter button of your eyes." We galloped risks of heart attacks with them to Crokna at the western end, which signaled on their echo radio, "Port turn by 95 degrees. And so the buoyant convoy sailed southwards out to deep, deep sea, and uswards in to memories as deep. Now a tune. If you can tolerate two more, I'll read these two. First of all, one, the kite that wouldn't fly, something I observed in the Canary Island of Fuerteventura. The kite that wouldn't fly, it wouldn't fly for the owner anyhow. And it put me in mind of a cameo from my teaching days in Farm Furs when I saw it. Page 18. The kite that wouldn't fly. The man tried everything. He ran with the cord, but the kite only hobbled behind like a dog that was lame. He awaited a flurry of wind, but all it did then was to tie demented knots and hang itself and die. He dressed up the tail with more tassels, but the nose wouldn't cock with conceit. His wife took a role as a pylon, but the kite pitched from her bridge like a resolute suicide case. Every different length of cord saw another pilot maimed with a cracked skull or dislocated hips. His final try was on a knoll where he stood buoyed with theories of updraft air, but that endeavor lacked even the compensation of a heady stoop. Limp as a leaf, it dropped. When he trudged back through clinging eyes, he hid the kite behind his back, as though it were a child of whom he was ashamed. And I remember from my teaching time, a pupil, no Orion in the night, walking towards me at the tail of an exam with his answer paper in that very guise behind his back, ashamed to show the foolscap, let alone the answers. And I remember how, my red pencil blunted in the heart, I came to a decision there and then to lift him, words unseen, for effort only, out of his bog onto the fine field of the past percent. And I conclude with a poem about my cat. I can find it. I can find my cat when I go home. Just a sec now. This is called Ash Wednesday Sermon to my cat. My cat is called Majesté. He used to be called Bib and Boots because he had a lovely white bib here, right? He still has the bib and four white boots. And I called him Bib and Boots. But then I discovered that his personality was one of majesty. He fancies himself as royalty. He stands like a royal, he eats like a royal, he poses like a royal. So I decided that Bib and Boots wasn't dignified enough, royal enough, majestic enough, so I called him Majesté. And this is a particular sermon to Majesté on Ash Wednesday. You'll have to do some fasting, Majesté, in reparation for your grievous sins. How many times have you obscured my view of Epsom Downs or Fairy House by leaping on the television stand to ogle all the roguish mice you see? And where are all the blue-tipped geishas gone? Thou shalt not kill the beautiful. And you are not responsive in the nights to hand claps echoing off walls when you should be bed-blanketed instead of north in Leary's field vigiling with rabbits. Why won't you obey? You have to do some fasting. My mistake. You have to do some fasting, my mistake, in reparation for your faults of character. You snarl and spit at Max, the gentle Labrador, all out of racial prejudice. Beg for food? Not you. Hooper's is the chair you bring to table. You are waited on with plate, where you have splayed your paws commandingly. I hold the flower bed, and you decide your sybarite. It is a scented new latrine. Only if I'm watching will you soar up on the rocket of the sycamore and hang like a koala by one arm out along a daring branch, you blatant exhibitionist. And you're a devious cat with scheming eye on sportive back. You land a sucker punch on me and make my veins to yelp the very time my fingers fondle play. You'll have to do some fasting. My mistake.